is the assurance that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala loves us in return. And that is the difficult part of it. And that's where every Muslim will always pray. May that be the truth. That I love Allah and Allah also loves me. But there is only one example that I can see. If you really want to see a divine certification about a person that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, I love him, that's none other than Ali bin Abi Talib alayhi salatu wa salam.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. The British establishment and political class have colluded with and given succour to the Israeli regime for 75 years. But it seems that British collaboration with Israel is entering a new phase after an agreement on bilateral relations was signed last month. We'll be discussing what this means in practice after Latifa Abu Chakra's report on Britain's deepening relationship with the Zionist entity.
On March 21st, 2023, the British Foreign Secretary James Cleverly and Eli Cohen, the Foreign Minister of the Zionist entity, signed an important agreement laying out the 2030 roadmap for UK-Israel bilateral relations. While trade between Britain and Israel has increased by 73% across the last decade, leading to a point where 400 Israeli tech companies alone operate on British soil, it seems a new era of collaboration is upon us. Israel has been elevated to a Tier 1 cyber partner with Britain, which will entail deeper integration. Few within the British elite are questioning this relationship, even after it was revealed that around 400 British citizens, including then-serving Prime Minister Boris Johnson, had their phones hacked by Pegasus spyware from the Israeli tech firm NSO Group. In contrast to the US government, which promptly blacklisted the NSO Group, Britain not only took no action against the company at all, but has now deepened cyber relations with the squatter entity. In fact, there are several ways in which Israeli cyber infrastructure has directly inspired British intelligence services. It is known that Israel grooms its agents for the Unit 8200 Military Intelligence Unit from age 9, teaching cyber skills as an official part of their curriculum and plucking out gifted children to be streamlined into a unit through a program called Magshimim. The largest British intelligence agency, GCHQ, has learned from and adapted this technique for its own use in schools with the Cyber Discovery Program. It is also known that the Cyber Central Park being constructed as a part of the Golden Valley development in Gloucestershire, close to the headquarters of GCHQ, takes its inspiration from CyberSpark, Israel's own cyber innovation arena. The Golden Valley development is a British Department for International Trade project with Israeli investment that aims to establish a British cyber base in the Beersheba Zionist settlement in occupied Palestine. The New Deal also indicates that Britain will work with Israel to ensure joint approaches towards counter-terrorism and counter-incitement against Israel on social media. An interesting part of the agreement is Britain's promise to tackle the singling out of Israel in the Human Rights Council. In addition to that, the British government pledges to stand against the consensus of human rights organisations by opposing the use of the term apartheid in reference to the Zionist entity. Britain and Israel are working together against the region, and this pact deepens the bond.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest expert today is a UK-based Palestinian activist, Huda Amori. As our regular viewers will know, Huda is a good friend of the show. She co-founded the groundbreaking and inspirational Palestine Action Group that's radicalising the Palestine Solidarity Movement. And she's spearheading efforts to expose Israeli weapons manufacturers based on UK soil. And Huda joins us by Skype today. Welcome to the show. David, what do you make of this 2030 roadmap between Israel and the UK?
Well, it's an indication, isn't it, of deepening relationships between the UK elite and the UK intelligence services and the equivalent bodies in the Zionist entity. So it's a concerning development given everything else that's happening in the world, which is that moving away from the idea of a unipolar world in subservience to the US. But it's interesting, though, that this is a different approach than the US appears to be taking. So the US seems much more cautious about having this kind of relationship with the Zionist entity. And so, for example, the NSO company, which was tapping politicians' phones, was immediately banned by the Americans. But the British did nothing about it. So there's a really interesting distinction there, where the Americans are saying, you know, to the Israelis, no, you can't do this. And Britain's, like, quite happy for Israeli intelligence to actually be tapping UK politicians' phones. Extraordinary.
Well, Huda, one company that wasn't referenced in any of the documents relating to the deal was Elbit Systems. Why do you think Elbit wasn't mentioned?
Well, as you know, Elbit has been our main target of Palestine Action since we've launched in July 2020. In the last military trade agreement between the UK and Israel, Elbit was heavily mentioned, and it followed by them gaining a contract, which they later lost due to the activities of Palestine Action, where we have been blockading, occupying and destroying Elbit's weapons manufacturers across Britain. And through that process, we have exposed Elbit Systems for what they are and sullied their name in the public. So I think because Elbit has become a toxic brand and they decided to omit the mention of Elbit in this trade agreement, but that does not make this trade agreement any less shocking. Or not shocking necessarily, but any less disturbing and something that must be challenged, because Israel itself is a toxic brand and we must work harder to make sure that no future agreements are made between this country and Israel.
I mean, David, do you think that Palestine Action's activities have got something to do with Elbit not featuring in the agreement?
Well, it seems pretty clear that's the case. And of course, this may be that Elbit are not involved, which would be a stunning victory, but it may also be that Elbit are involved, but they've just chosen not to say it, which again would be a victory in the sense that they're forced to remove the name of Elbit from the agreement. So that's in either case a clear victory for Palestine Action, but it shows also the need to keep up the pressure, because we still don't know if Elbit actually is involved, but they're just keeping it quiet, and that's one of the key things which we should be trying to find out as this process moves on.
So do you think that's a possibility then, that they could be doing that? I mean, how would they be doing that if they are doing that, do you think?
Well, I mean, one doesn't know. I mean, they're quite capable of omitting information, of using distorted information. The British state, they have a long, long history of such things, and we see it every day, lies from the British government. So who knows how they would be doing that, but it seems to me plausible that they might simply have omitted the name rather than excluded Elbit from the process.
But it's certainly something that we will seek to find out, and we'll bring that news, if we find out, to our viewers, of course. But, Huda, I mean, do you know anything about the Golden Valley development in Gloucestershire that's mentioned in the agreement?
Yeah, so this just came to our attention when this new agreement came out, which is based in Gloucester, which has it's very diverse city, so it's a very interesting place to put it, right next to GCHQ. But whether it's the military or tech industry, it all comes down to Israel having to sustain its military occupation over the Palestinian people. And therefore, it builds new technology, builds new military infrastructure, which starts off in Palestine. And now we're seeing they're trying to expand this to Britain. And it's basically making a whole industry off the oppression of the Palestinian people. And potentially, I think it's quite convenient that it's right next to the British intelligence services, where we can see again the potential for our data to be compromised and for the Israeli military to have some sort of ability to work more closely with our intelligence services in this country.
Mm. David, what do you think it means that Israel's now a tier one cyber partner of the UK?
Well, it's a label suggesting that they're one of the most important partners for cyber activities. But it's not something which is new in the sense that they've previously been a high-level cyber partner. It's just an official designation of Tier 1, which means that they work very, very closely with the UK and that there's a kind of interpenetration of both business and intelligence operations, meaning in particular cybersecurity and the ability to protect from and indeed to do hacking and surveillance. So this is, you know, clearly a further integration of UK and Israeli intelligence, which is extremely worrying because, of course, it means that the Israeli intelligence agencies have more access to data which is of national security concerns for the UK. So it's a kind of penetration of Israeli intelligence into Britain's national security architecture, which, of course, is really extremely worrying for anyone who is concerned about the Zionist entity's abuses of human rights, which, of course, we see on the television every day.
Mm. An interesting question which pops into my mind is, who's the senior partner here? Is it Britain
is it the question. I mean, in the case of the US, you can plainly see that the US is saying to the Israelis, there are certain things you're not allowed to do.
Sure. Now,
there doesn't seem to be any limits for the British government. They're quite happy to get into bed with the Israelis at a very, very detailed level. Now, I imagine, we have no indication that British firms are involved in national security and cyber protection in Israel, but there are 400 Israeli tech firms based on operating in this country. And many of them, of course, are stuffed with people who've come straight out of Israeli intelligence organizations. Mm-hmm. This is a real national security issue, but there's hardly anybody in the national security state who's willing to recognize that.
But why hasn't there been any pushback then, do you think?
Well, because those forces within the national security state who used to regard Israel as a threat to our national security, going way back to 1950, in fact, when Mossad penetrated the national security apparatus for the first time and was recognised by MI5. But that section of the British intelligence services who saw Israel as a national security threat, I think it has been under threat, has been getting smaller. Yeah. And we don't see really much sign that there's much of it left.
No. Well, Huda, I mean, what was Palestine Action's response to this deal?
Well, to this deal and to general complicity between Britain and Israel, our goal is to end all British complicity with the colonisation of Palestine. And so, therefore, our response to this is that we will work harder and we need more people to join the fight against British complicity in order to tackle it in every single form that it manifests. And we're going to continue to double our efforts against shutting down Elbit Systems, Israel's largest arms firm, in this country. And we will move on to dismantle all complicity. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of people in this country who are willing to do so and will fight against this continually increasing ties between this state and the apartheid state of Israel.
Mm. Well, we'll return to our discussion in a moment after this report about the growing links between the UK's current political leaders and Zionist economic interests.
The New Deal signed between the British government and the Israeli regime brings into question the deep integration of the British political elite with Zionist economic interest. The family of the current British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, directly profits from a company led by a former agent of Israeli Military Intelligence Unit 8200. His billionaire father-in-law, Narayana Murthy, founded the tech company Infosys in 1981. Since then, the firm has grown into a behemoth, bringing in $16 billion in revenue annually. Sunak's wife, Akshata Murthy, has shares in her father's company Infosys and collects £11.5 million in annual dividends from the company. In 2012, Infosys signed a memorandum of understanding with Israel to establish and enhance cooperation in industrial research and development. Since then, Infosys has acquired Israeli subsidiaries, LivePerson Inc., CloudIn, and Panaya, all of which employ former Israeli military and intelligence personnel at high levels. Infosys was also the key seed investor in Cloud Endure, a tech company founded by Ofer Gadish, Leonard Feinberg, and Ofer Ehrlich, all of whom are alumni of the Israeli Military Intelligence Corps. Infosys has also employed Yotam Kreman as a process specialist. Kreman was formerly the Deputy Chief of Mission of Israel in Portugal for almost 4 years prior to his work with the Sunak family company. Infosys also appointed Yuri Levine as director. Levine emerged out of Israeli Military Intelligence Unit 8200 and went on to co-found the traffic navigation app Waze. In a properly functioning democracy, the Israeli associations of the Sunak family business would come under far more scrutiny.
David, what do you know about Infosys?
So Infosys is this tech company started in 1981, still based largely in India, by Sunak's then future father-in-law. Mm. It's a huge company. It's amongst the top 600 companies in the world, public companies, and it has a huge range of divisions. It does a lot of engineering work. It has its own university in India. It also has a management consultancy arm, and so it's a huge tech company which people don't know much about, as with many tech companies, and so it has a big economic role, but it also has an important political role. So that although it's Indian founded, it has literally been stuffed with people who've come from the Zionist entity, and especially from Zionist intelligence organizations, particularly Unit 8200, which of course is the Israelis' equivalent of GCHQ, the surveillance and cybersecurity intelligence agency. So there's a concern here, of course, but with the confluence between, in particular, the right-wing support for Modi in India and the Zionist entity, which, of course, the ideas in those movements are very similar. And so it's a company which is, having effectively an important influence on British life, but there's hardly any reporting about it, as the film showed there. I mean, if this was a proper democracy in the UK, then there would be proper reporting, and the journalists would be doing exposés on Rishi Sunak's links with both with this company and indeed with the Zionist entity.
Well, of course, that's a whole other question. We could devote several programmes to the state of British democracy, couldn't we? But Tudor, what does Infosys tell us about Rishi Sunak's relationship with Israel, do you think?
Well, it shows that he's obviously got a massive conflict of interest and that he's going to favour the interests of the apartheid state. And this recent signing of this deal inviting Netanyahu just demonstrates that even further. But what I would also say is that we know that every successive government for the past century has played a part in the colonisation of Palestine. And Sunak is no exception. And I'm sure whoever follows him, because I'm sure he won't last very long, will play the exact same role, and that the complicity between the Britain and the Zionist entity is a very top-down system of complicity. And for us as activists, our main focus needs to be building it from the bottom up, because that is where we have power, and that is where the grassroots of this country do support the people of Palestine. And that's where we need to focus our efforts in building that and taking the power back into the people to dismantle that complicity.
Mm. Well, and of course, you talk about he may not last very long. I mean, Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, is probably the likely successor. And he says he's a Zionist without qualification. I mean, what's your sort of, what's the prospects, do you think, going forward if we see a Sir Keir Starmer premiership?
Well, it seems that both sides are just competing to see who's the bigger Zionist at this rate. I don't think there'll be any difference. If anything, part of me believes that it's more lethal to have someone who's a Labour leader who is pretending under the facade of being slightly more liberal, who is so keen on supporting the oppression of the Palestinian people. So I think either way, it shouldn't really change our stance as activists on the ground, because it seems to be a constant status quo that every government, whichever side they're on, is competing to show how much they can support in a foreign apartheid state, which is just bizarre. But that's the situation that we're in. And being in the imperial court, it also provides clarity for us as the people of what we can do and where our power lies. And our power doesn't lie in trying to lobby or persuade politicians, because they are completely aware of the fact, but it's more convenient for them to increase the ties between the apartheid state of Israel and to maintain their power. And I think that has a lot to do with the GCHQ trying to recruit school children as well. Yes. To become spies. It's all a system of divide and conquer and maintaining control and creating distrust within the grassroots of this country. Yeah. And we have to stay strong and resilient against that.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, David, just moving on, I mean, we've covered the Israeli Intelligence Corps, Unit 8200, several times on this show before, haven't we? Can you just say a little bit more about Unit 8200 for us?
So, as with most states, the Zionist entity has a signals intelligence agency like GCHQ or the National Security Agency in the US. And, of course, that's different to its domestic intelligence unit. In Israel, it's called the Shabak or the Shin Bet. And its external intelligence unit called the Mossad, like the MI6 in the UK. So it's a signals intelligence agency. Mm. It's in the military. GCHQ is not sat in the military, but it's in the military in Israel. And the strategy that they've adopted is they have people who've come out of 8200 who have gone off into the tech business. And this appears to be a foreign policy strategy of the Israeli government itself. And so we find tech companies all over the world. We've just been mentioning Infosys, stuffed with people from Israeli intelligence backgrounds. We already mentioned the fact that there are 400 Israeli tech firms active in the UK, 400 of them. Mm. And most of those will have people from the Israeli intelligence agencies, particularly Unit 8200. I mean, the people from 8200 get everywhere. I mean, you mentioned Keir Starmer a minute ago. Mm. And, of course, the Labour Party has a guy called Asaf Kaplan, who is a graduate of Unit 8200, running the digital media strategy. So, I mean, this is all over the UK politics and business. Sure. Are people from who are Israeli, ex-Israeli intelligence operatives, and who will still presumably be involved in some way in that role in their new ventures.
Of course, and all this, of course, was under the radar for many, many years, but Palestine Declassified is at least shining a light now on these sort of activities. But Huda, I mean, what about the idea of GCHQ applying the Unit 8200 maximum model to grooming kids? I mean, you mentioned this a moment ago in British schools, to become cyber spies. I mean, it sounds pretty ominous, doesn't it?
It sounds like child abuse to me, to put it frankly. The thing is, in this country, is what we have is a system of indoctrination from very young, from the curriculum, which omits the imperial and colonial past and present day of this country, to then trying to recruit kids from the age of 16 to work for the GCHQ. It's trying to eliminate the ability for young people in this country to critically think and question the systems of power, and instead it's indoctrinating them into basically spying on their own communities, which is quite frankly disgusting. And it's the trajectory we're going down in this country. And it's not necessarily new, this idea of spying on people. The undercover cop spy inquiry is happening right now, which involves spying on activists a few decades ago. But this is something that's getting worse, in the sense that they're now trying to recruit school children into these same types of systems of surveillance on the British people.
Yeah, I mean, it's another blow against, in my opinion, British democracy. But as I've said, we could spend probably several programmes talking about the state of British democracy. But, David, I mean, it's rather curious, isn't it, that even after the NSO Group's Pegasus spyware was used to hack the phones of 400 British residents, I mean, you touched on this in an earlier answer, including the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, it still wasn't officially blacklisted by the British government. And as you say, it was blacklisted by the US administration. It really does indicate, doesn't it, that it's the kind of, isn't it, tail wagging of the dog. I mean, who's pulling the strings here? It's incredible, isn't it?
It is incredible. But let's look at it. The case of the NSO group is interesting because this was a story which was brought into the public domain by a French NGO called Forbidden Stories. And this was something which was not something the Israeli government wanted to happen. So they were opposed to this happening, yeah, and they were concerned about it. But immediately the Americans banned the group. Now, what's going on there is that the Americans are saying to the Israelis, we are in charge, yes, of this. We will be doing this kind of surveillance. You are not allowed to do it. You're a junior partner in this relationship. Now, there's no similar things being said from Britain. But, of course, let's look at this. The organisation Forbidden Stories, which got the story out in the first place, is actually funded by the National Endowment for Democracy, yes, i.e. a CIA pass-through. So we have a clear indication that the Americans not only are saying that the Israelis can't do this, but they're actually sponsoring the unearthing of stories about the Israelis in order to put them back in the box. Yeah. The British are not doing that.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks to our guests, Huda Amori, and our resident expert, Professor David Miller. So, until next time, when we'll be back with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In Britain, record high inflation has caused soaring prices and a cost of living crisis. Additionally, many workers have gone on strike because of the cost of living crisis. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Independent has covered this story and tells us more. A new survey has revealed 1 in 5 students at UK top universities are considering dropping out because of the worsening cost of living crisis across the country, and a quarter are regularly going without food and other essentials. New research by the Russell Group Students Union, which represents 24 of Britain's most elite higher education institutions, suggests that more than 20% of the students at high-ranking universities, such as University College London and Edinburgh University, are under the intense pressure of soaring prices, being forced to quit their studies. More than half of those surveyed said they are experiencing concentration problems caused by poor nourishment and financial stress, as their academic performance is negatively influenced by the deepening crisis. The survey of more than 8,500 university students carried out in the first 2 months of this year also found some students feeling suicidal, suffering from severe anxiety and loneliness. Some said their families were not turning on the heating at home so that their student children could eat. Dr. Tim Bradshaw, the Russell Group's chief executive, depicted the finding of the study as worrying and said they're yet to get worse. He called on the government to take urgent action by addressing flaws in the maintenance loan system and raising loans in line with soaring inflation. The group also called on the government to consider reintroducing maintenance grants or hardship loan support for students who are grappling with the country's deteriorating economic situation. The damning report also revealed that the proportion of students who were considering dropping out of university rose to more than 3 in 10 among the most socio-economically disadvantaged. According to researchers, the current economic failure across the country could lead to universities being only open to the most privileged students, undoing the progress on broadening higher education access. Danny Bradford, Policy and Research Manager at Students' Union, University College London, who led the research, said, "We're really running a risk where our university system is only open to the most privileged students." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. A leading investigation company on consumer affairs has warned 1 in 7 people in the United Kingdom skip meals and sit in cold homes due to the worsening cost of living crisis. According to the latest findings from Which? Consumer Insight Tracker, an alarming number of British households are going without food and cannot afford their energy bills, as rising inflation and high energy costs put pressure on incomes. The findings also suggest that almost 1 in 10 Britons had prioritised meals for other family members above themselves. A 72-year-old citizen from West Suffolk told Which? That the last week of the month, meals are missed. If you have no money for a loaf of bread, then there's no lunch, and if there's no milk, then there's no breakfast. She complained, "Basic groceries have gone up to stupid levels. The loaf of bread I usually buy has gotten smaller and more expensive." Inflation in Britain's grocery market has soared to a record high of 17.1%, hitting prices for milk and eggs the hardest this month. According to market researcher Kantar, this could increase the cost of a family's typical buying basket by £811 a year. Tesco, Britain's biggest supermarket chain, said recently that it had temporarily capped the number of packs of tomato, pepper and cucumber to 3 per customer. It blamed poor weather in Spain and North Africa for the shortages that the British government warned could last a month. Meanwhile, the investigation body said, as people are grappling with the skyrocketing costs, 7 in 10 are putting their heating on less, 4 in 10 are using less hot water, and 1 in 5 have cooked fewer meals. Furthermore, the low incomes caused 2.3 million households last month to miss a vital payment, such as their mortgage payment, rent, credit card, or bill payment. Food prices, along with those of numerous other goods used in daily life, have increased primarily as a result of the rise in energy costs since the start of the war between Ukraine and Russia last year. The surging costs and low incomes have prompted the less well-off families to stage nationwide strikes, asking for fair payments. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered this story and tells us more. A leading youth charity has revealed nearly half of Britain's young population fear they will never earn enough money to support a family as the cost of living crisis deepens across the country. Releasing its 2023 Youth Index recently, the Prince's Trust, a youth charity that has carried out a survey among 16 to 25-year-olds in Britain during a 14-year period, revealed that 45% of these youngsters in the United Kingdom have no hope of establishing a new family because of the soaring cost of living. The charity said the age group's happiness and confidence is at its lowest level since it started the research in 2008, and they are most unhappy about their money and mental health. The report revealed that 57% of young people said the cost of living crisis is their biggest worry for the future, while 34% said the coming recession is their greatest concern. About 46% said they felt hopeless about the future due to economic uncertainty. The data, which is from an online YouGov opinion poll of more than 2,000 young people in Britain, showed that 39% of the age group 16 to 25 from less affluent backgrounds agreed that thinking about money depresses or stresses them. The Prince's Trust UK Chief Executive Jonathan Townsend said, "Having already lived through one of the most turbulent times to be young, this year's Prince's Trust NatWest Youth Index is a warning sign that post-pandemic young people's well-being has not recovered." Jonathan Townsend added, "Most concerningly, the report also suggests that these challenges are hitting young people from the most disadvantaged backgrounds hardest, with those who receive free school meals or who are unemployed reporting consistently worse well-being in all aspects of life." According to the Prince's Trust report, around 64% of respondents said their biggest goal in life is achieving financial security. The study also revealed that around 70% believe that having a job that gives them financial stability is good for their mental health as well, while 59% say being employed at all was good for their mental well-being. However, 47% were worried about the impact of a looming recession on their job security, rising to 52% among those from a poorer background.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we answer your questions, queries you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Well, today in our studio, we have with us a guest speaker, Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at Al-Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum, sir.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Professor, we would want to start with audience question again. How do we make our child close towards the religious obligations like carrying out prayers and fasting? And the fasting is here, so...
Yes, as we've been saying all the time, that we need to start with providing the model ourselves. We should be the role models. We should be implementing what we are preaching. What we expect our children to do from a very tender age, we should be able to do it ourselves. So we want them to recite the Quran. We want them to offer prayers on time. We want them to fast. So depending on their age, it depends on how we deal with the situation. They will do so at the early ages in imitating you, following you, what you do. They want you to become happy with them. You have shown them your love. So, and those first second seven years, it's easier to do so. It's better to do so, especially while we're in the holy months of Rajab and Shaban and the holy month of Ramadan. It's a whole, environment which can be created in our homes, revolving around prayers, revolving around fasting, revolving around supplications and du'as, especially in these three holy months. It's a whole, university for us of ibadah, of worship, of learning, of loving. And so this is a very good occasion to be able to latch onto the spiritual aspects of these months and to provide the environment to our children. And of course, we need to show them and teach them how to do those things properly. We need to employ even the services of teachers and mentors in this direction, in this way. But the most important thing is that we talk to them, speak to them, and we are able to convince them, especially those teenagers who need answers. Again, we need to be able to satisfy them. Fasting, especially in the months of winter, it's quite easy. Even in the months
when
of summer.
In the summers.
Even in the summers. The best, the most rewarding are the summer fasts.
Fasts, yeah.
So we need to prepare our children to undergo difficulties and to be able to handle difficult situations, and we may need to make them patient. So we need to teach them patience. We need to teach them how to strive, how to, remain firm on what we want to do and not to, slip away from the path or divert from the path. We need to remain on the path towards Allah Almighty. So we need to be able to teach them to always seek guidance from Allah.
Iyyaka
na'budu wa iyyaka nasta'in. He seeks guidance, we seek His help. We seek His assistance. We ask for perseverance in His path and seek that strength from Allah Almighty. So we may need to make them realize that everything that we do in this world is based upon Allah's help. And if we are able to inculcate that in our children, then we will not have to face any difficulties. But the problem with us nowadays is that ourselves, we are not very much able to
act, actually.
Yes.
Act, basically.
Act accordingly, and to be able to show the fact that we are doing this with the help of Allah Almighty. Sometimes we do things and we make ourselves feel that we're doing it on our own. We are doing it because of us.
No, especially when we have achievements. Professor, we will discuss more with you after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Al-Kavi. And Professor, you're helping us understand that. You said how we can actually make our child a little more religious than whatever they are, or whatever the behavior they have. Well, you said the holy months, like there's Rajab, there is Shaban, there is Ramadan. We can help them. These are the months that give us opportunity to actually make our children know more about religion. But the question that I have here is that on the very first day of Ramadan, the very first dua, the daily prayers that we have, in the very first dua, we have this very line that, O Allah, make my fasts among the fasts of those who fast sincerely. Make my standing in the prayers of those who stand obediently. If a child asks us now a question, what does it mean to fast obediently? What does it mean to fast sincerely? Or what does it mean to stand obediently?
Yes, that would be a very good question if he does that, and it would be difficult for us to answer if we're not doing it ourselves. So we need to be sincere ourselves.
Yeah.
And how do we show that sincerity? We need to make him understand, or make her understand, that working, doing anything with sincerity for someone is when you are focused completely on that activity. For example, if you're going to school early in the morning and you need to be at school at 7 o'clock in the morning, you need to be ready by 6 o'clock, breakfast done or whatever, and then prepared with school uniform on, and then you're going to rush towards your school. In that 1 hour that you need to get to your school, you need to catch a bus, you need to get a taxi or whatever. So your whole focus, attention is towards reaching that target, getting to the, or you need to make a journey. You need to take a flight. You need to be there at 7 o'clock at the airport. Then all your focus, all your attention is towards that journey and
yeah.
getting there on time. You forget everything else. Everything comes and passes away. But the focus and attention is on the time that you want to get to the airport.
Yeah.
So what is your state of mind? What is your state of mind at that in doing that? Your whole focus is doing that.
Yeah.
So when you get up in the morning for prayers, for eating your suhoor and getting ready for the fast, your whole intention is to prepare yourself for the day of fasting.
Yeah.
So when you get up with this intention that you want to fast today, and it's your first day of Ramadan, it's the first day of Ramadan, then you are very much aware of the fact that today is the first day of the month of Ramadan. I need to get up. I need to have the suhoor. Then I have to go for ablution and prepare myself for the prayers.
Yeah.
So everything is with this intention to get there on time.
Yeah.
So you forget everything else. Your focus is on that. That is purity and sincerity in your intention. And then the purity intention and attention comes in the actions also, with the purpose in mind, the focus in mind, the target in mind. Everything you do is for that sake.
Yeah. So,
and especially if you have started 2 or 3 days earlier in the month of the Sha'ban, and you have kept fast in the month of Rajab, you have prepared yourselves, you have primed yourself.
Easy for you.
So it's become much easier. So the month of Ramadan does not become a big hurdle or a huge burden. No, you need to prime yourself. And so Rajab starts with the month of Allah Almighty.
Yes.
The Sha'ban is the month of the Holy Prophet, and Ramadan is the month of the Ummah to get salvation, as it is mentioned in the Hadith also.
Indeed.
So we need to, consider this as a whole process.
It's a series of processes to be achieving
and
salvation.
And even then it doesn't stop. Zilqa'dah and Zilhajjah still remain to be, benefited from. So,
let's ask
all
you,
these months are the months of God which we can, take the
benefit from. Let's ask you more after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
Ya Muqiyya al-Khayrat, Ya Muqiyya al-Khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, he who has a child must treat him in a childish manner.
Ya Muqiyya al-Khayrat, Ya Muqiyya al-Khayrat.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I am Zainab with Professor Salman Naqvi. And Professor, you were helping us that how we can make our child understand what is sincere fasting and what is obedient standing in the prayers.
So we mentioned the fact of the sincerity in our intention that we are focused on an activity, we need to get that done, we are primed for it, that is important. Then how to be obedient is to do things as we have been asked to do. Take care in carrying out simple actions in a very, very precise way. For example, when we fast, when we pray, prayers, apart from the thinking that goes in it, the feelings that go into it, we have these physical actions which we carry out. Qiyam and ruku and sujood, they should be done in a very precise manner,
right,
in a very, you know, perfect manner. The more we perfect our actions and we make them our recitation, our pronunciation of the Arabic Quranic words, the more we make them perfect, the more perfection and sincerity will be reflected in our actions. So in fasting, of course, it's all, the fasting is all about not doing, refraining from things, not doing things, not eating, not, for example, drinking, and refraining from things which are supposed to be, you know, taken care of. So it's all in a sense a negative way of dealing with the.
It's actually gaining a control over your nafs.
Exactly. You need to stop doing things. It's not doing in the prayers, in salah, you're doing things. In fasting, you're refraining from things. So, you know, you see the beauty of it. Both ways are you positive actions and negative things. And negating things is important. How you control your feelings, how you control your actions, how you control. Of course, there are levels to fasting, of course. There's the physical level where you refrain from drinking, from smoking, from eating, and many things which are at the physical level. But then you have the mental level and you have the level of the heart and the feelings. The pure fasting is where you even desist from bad feelings coming into your heart, feeling bad about things, feeling negatively about things, or even thinking apart from something which is good. Thinking should also be, you should refrain from things which are bad, from wasting our time, from thinking about things which are not relevant to us. We should be focused on things which are important in life. So fasting provides us the opportunity to refrain from so many things and to get engaged in and engage, control our physical activities, control our feelings, control our thoughts, and to focus them on things which are important.
Which are more important.
And what is more important is to live a life, a pure life, according to Allah Almighty's commands.
Yeah. And so we can also teach our child, like, if you want to have, if you want to, the anger that has become dominant over you right now, if you want to overcome this, there is a month, there is a way wherein we refrain from things that we want to do, that we like to do, like eating and drinking. As Lady Zahra Salam Alayha put it very beautifully, she said that fasting is not just refraining from eating and drinking, it's actually refraining your eyes from seeing anything negative, it's actually refraining your ears from hearing anything negative, it's actually being fasting with each and every part of your body, refraining from everything that is not allowed in Islam. Well, thank you, Professor. That was all the time we had for today. Thank you so much for being with us. And dear listeners, may Allah give us the opportunity to be among those who fast sincerely and obediently. And that's how we can actually teach our children to be sincere and obedient in religious obligations. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent.
and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.